Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, dedicated to a healthcare system that works for all Californians, on the web at chcf.org.
From Valley Public Radio, serving Central California from Bakersfield to Merced, this is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, California's high-speed rail project is back in the news once again, thanks to a new effort to stop it. We'll learn why Kings County's lawsuit that alleges the project is unconstitutional has new life in 2017. We'll also learn how a number of organic farming pioneers here in the Valley are dealing with a big issue of change this year, whether to continue with their business at all or to pass it on to the next generation. Plus, a look at new books by authors from Fresno State. That's all coming up later in our program. We begin our show, though, with the biggest story of this new year, and that's the weather. In a few minutes, we'll talk with the National Weather Service and find out what's in store and how this storm shapes up with others that the Valley has seen over the years, including the big storm in 1997 that caused major flooding throughout Central California. This go-around, though, one community has been especially hard hit, and that's up in the Madera County Mountains in the town of North Fork. Valley Public Radio's Jeffrey Hess went there yesterday. Here's his report.
I'm standing on the banks of what's normally a peaceful mountain creek, but is now a broad, fast-moving river. The days of heavy rains have caused the Madera County Sheriff to order evacuations in some of the low-lying areas of the town of North Fork, south of Bass Lake. Selma Metzger lives in a mandatory evacuation zone. She stands by what used to be a creek and looks out at her home, which is just inches above the water on pylons, but currently completely surrounded by the flood.
Well, I was really bad yesterday, but today I'm feeling, I think that everything's going to be okay. As soon as it goes past, if it stops raining and everything goes past, it'll be okay, I think.
Metzger is currently living up the hill in a trailer with relatives until the flood recedes. This is not the first time that she's seen her home nearly flooded out. The last time was almost two decades ago to the day, when heavy rains and snowmelt filled the many mountain creeks and streams.
We did this about 20 years ago, same time and stuff, so we had, it was a little worse 20 years ago, but now it's, I don't know. We still have our house, though.
Down the street from her home, Talon Wood is trying to fix a tire to get a long stationary mobile home at the Bass Lake Mobile Home Park up and moving again. The park is in a low-lying area next to a former stream and in a mandatory evacuation zone. Wood says he has lived his whole life in the area, but never seen the creek rise so fast.
No, never. When I was a kid, it got pretty high, but never that high. I think it's pretty crazy that it didn't seem like it rained that much, but I guess it did. It really filled up real quick.
Residents have piled much of the contents of their homes in big stacks outside under flapping blue tarps. It's an attempt to make the trailers lighter so trucks can move them to higher ground. However, some can't be moved at all, leaving resident Sandra DeBoard to evacuate and hope her home is still standing when she's allowed to return.
How awful. That's scary. I mean, I don't know. I don't know what to say about it because it's our home. I mean, who wants to lose their home?
This mobile home park was only recently added to the list of mandatory evacuations. DeBoard says she's disappointed, not only by the late notice to leave or else, but also by a sense that not enough water was released before the rains that, in her mind, contribute to the flooding. Even areas not in mandatory or even recommended evacuation zones are feeling the effect of the midwinter storms, which are compounding the damage of recent mountain wildfires. Leroy Skip and his family built a small ridge to divert water from off of a hill just east of his property. He says the hill, less than 200 yards from his home, burned in the Willow Fire, leaving behind scorched trees and other waste that are now being caught up in the waters.
Well, the fire was right up there and burned the two homes down. So now not only do we have debris coming down from the burn area because it's just all silt and soot just washing down, there's nothing to hold it back anymore.
A sheriff's deputy I spoke to, who asked not to be recorded, says most residents in the tiny town are taking the threat of flood seriously and evacuating without too much trouble. However, the threat of losing their home and their possessions to a January flood remains a real and quite literally rising threat just yards away. In North Fork, for Valley Public Radio News, I'm Jeffrey Hess.
And here to tell us more about the ongoing weather situation in Central California, we have with us on the phone Scott Rowe, meteorologist with the National Weather Service in Hanford. Scott, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
I know it's a busy time for you right now, as we just finished with that one big storm over the weekend, but another one is on the way. What's happening here through Wednesday?
So we're going to see the chance of precipitation continue to increase across Central California as the day continues, and then overnight tonight for the Fresno area and folks in the valley, we're expecting anywhere between about 3/4 of an inch of rain upwards to maybe 1.25 inches. So we're not expecting as much precipitation with the storm, but nonetheless, with the previous storm systems that we've had, it's compounding to make things, the hydrologic issues, especially concerning.
Is this the same type of storm system like the one we had last weekend, or is this one different? In what way is it different?
It's very similar to the last one. It's coming from a rich moisture source. It's going to be a little bit cooler, though. One difference is the snow levels are going to be a lot lower with the storm. With the past weekend storm, we had snow levels that were rising as high as 10,000, 11,000 feet, which for January is not what we want to be seeing. With this current storm system, we're going to see snow levels. Right now, they're around 4,500 feet up to 5,500 feet. We're going to see them rise a little bit, but again, we're not expecting them to go really much higher than 7,000 or 7,500 feet.
Now, we cover a large area, as do you at the National Weather Service in Hanford. You forecast all throughout Central California. Are there some areas that fared better or worse in the recent storm over the weekend in terms of the amount of precip they received?
Sure. So some of the highest precipitation reports that we received were actually in excess of 12 inches of rain. Some of those locations were in Sequoia National Park, where upwards of 12.16 inches of rain fell over a 72-hour period of time through yesterday morning at Bear Trap Meadow. Washone Dam had 11 inches of rain. Lodgepole, 9.35 inches of rain. So those were some of the highest reports that we received. Up in Yosemite Valley, we received a report of 8.25 inches of rain over that 72-hour period of time. But in the valley, it was, of course, precipitation isn't as intense here. In the Fresno area, we received just over 1.75 inches of rain. It looks like 1.79, to be specific, in the Fresno area over those 72 hours with that storm system.
So how does this bring us up to date on the rainfall year so far? How is this 2016-2017 season shaping up at where we stand right now?
Sure. So the water year began on October 1st of 2016 and goes through September 30th of this current year. So far, Fresno has observed 6.99 inches of rain. Normally what we would see through this date is only 4.19 inches of rain, so that's putting us at nearly 3 inches above normal. And with this upcoming storm system expected to bring, you know, around 1 inch of precipitation to Fresno, we can very well be 3 inches above normal for this time of year by the time this next storm is all said and done.
Now, we also have a huge audience in Bakersfield listening to us on KPRX right now. How did Kern County fare?
Kern County did well in some locations, but unfortunately, with them doing so well, it also gave us some flooding concerns, especially in the Lake Isabella area. We received some reports of precipitation that exceeded 8 inches in a very short amount of time. Looks like Isabella Dam, they're one of our very reliable stations. They received 3.72 inches of rain in that 72-hour period of time that ended yesterday morning. But the previous storm system also gave us some headaches. So this was this weekend storm system was the second of a series of atmospheric rivers, and we received multiple reports in the middle part of last week with some flash flooding in the Lake Isabella area that closed multiple roadways for a long period of time.
You mentioned atmospheric river, and I've seen listeners send us questions about that recently, as that phrase has been in the news all over in 2017. What exactly are we talking about there? Is that just any big storm, or is that something much more specific when we're talking about what we had this last weekend?
Sure. So when atmospheric scientists refer to an atmospheric river, what we're talking about is a rich plume of moisture that originates from the tropics. So for the West Coast, that typically is from the southwest of here, going back to Hawaii, where we see a ribbon of rich moisture stream into California. And unfortunately, with that atmospheric river, some people call it the Pineapple Express, you would often see high amounts of precipitation concentrated in sometimes a very short amount of time, which is exactly what we saw happen in our part of the area. In addition, one of the consequences of atmospheric rivers is that they come with very warm air, and then you see the snow levels rise up, which is exactly what we saw with this last storm, where our snow level started off around 7,500 feet in some locations, but by the peak of the event, snow levels were above 10,000 feet, even 11,000 feet in some locations.
So we have this storm coming in through Wednesday, this system. What's the outlook beyond that? I know as further you get out, the less accurate things become as models diverge, and the science just is the way it is. But what is the outlook maybe for the rest of the month look like at this point?
Sure. So the Climate Prediction Center gives part of California a greater than likely chance of seeing above average precipitation through about the rest of the month, especially in the 8 to 14 day outlook, where pretty much all of California is bullseyed on at least having a 50% chance of exceeding normal precipitation values. For the short term, though, this storm system is probably going to be one of the last ones to impact us for at least the next 7 days. In the forecast for the San Joaquin Valley, we even have the chance of fog return to the area for the weekend.
Now, the other big elephant in the room here is the D word, drought. People are already saying, well, is this a drought buster? Is 2017 the year that goes away? Is it too soon to start throwing that around? And if it is, when should we start to look towards that?
Sure. It probably is still a little bit too early to, call it a drought buster, at least. We still need a lot of precipitation to make up for the year's deficits that we've accumulated over time. One thing, though, the drought monitor is published on a weekly basis, and we're taking a look at precipitation reports across the state over the, this past week at least, and we're looking at the drought monitor, and it will be published on Thursday this week.
All right. Well, we'll look forward to that. With this storm that's coming up right now, you still have some watches that are in effect for portions of our listening area. Tell us about that and also the potential for winds.
Sure. So we do have a winter storm warning in effect for the Sierra Nevada from Yosemite National Park south to the Tulare Kern County line. That is in effect for locations mainly above about 6,500 feet, where we can expect anywhere from 12 to 16 inches of snow to fall. Winds are going to be rather gusty with the storm as well. We do have a wind advisory in effect for the San Joaquin Valley that goes from 10 o'clock this morning through 10 a.m. Wednesday. We can see southerly winds that will go from about 10 to 15 miles an hour with potential gusts upwards of 40 miles an hour through today. We're going to have a cold front go through, and then the winds will become northwesterly overnight, and gusts can go even higher from that direction, especially as we go overnight and then into tomorrow morning, where they could go as high as 45 miles per hour.
Could that then present a problem with all the moisture we've had with trees and other issues like that?
Absolutely. So we do have very saturated soils with the past several storm systems. And so with gusty winds, potential for downed trees are very possible. The root systems, a lot of trees are dead over the years of drought. So they become a hazard. If winds were to topple them over, they can fall on power lines, creating some power outages in locations, as well as just unsecured belongings. If you have patio furniture, there's the potential that they could be blowing around tonight.
Now, the valley didn't get much rain, at least the valley floor in the Fresno area didn't get a lot of rain yesterday, but I did wake up this morning and see some new dusting of snow in the Sierra. Is that new, given the warm storm that came through over the weekend?
Yeah, so that is new. It's part of the next storm system that's beginning to impact the area. Snow levels are a little bit lower today, again, around 4,500 feet, upwards to 5,000 feet, I'd say. So it's just the beginning of the next storm to impact the area.
All right, again, Scott Rowe with us today from the National Weather Service in Hanford. He's a meteorologist, bringing us up to date on the storm that hit the valley this past weekend and also the one that's about to hit right now. As far as timing, Scott, what would you anticipate precip here on the valley floor, rain falling here?
So for the Fresno area, it would probably be after the noon hours, potentially as late as sunset or dinner time for some folks, especially from Fresno County northward. For folks southward, it probably will likely begin overnight tonight and continue tomorrow with the best chance of precipitation occurring.
All right. Well, we'll go ahead and follow that and hope there's more. Not too much, but just enough, as we are very eager to have the drought wrapped up. Scott Rowe with the National Weather Service and Hanford Meteorologist joining us today on Valley Edition. Scott, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
And stay with us on Valley Edition. We'll be back in just a moment and learn how many Valley organic farmers are undergoing a big transition in their operations, a transition to either a new generation, maybe selling their farms, or exiting the business entirely. That's all coming up straight ahead on Valley Edition. You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. As the generation that pioneered organic farming begins to retire, many are searching for different ways to continue their agricultural legacy. Some growers are passing their farms to their kids, but as FM89's Ezra David Romero reports, not all organic growers are as lucky to have a second generation that wants to take over the family farm.
When longtime organic farmers Tom and Dinesh Willie decided that it was time to retire, they turned to their kids to see if they wanted to take over the farm. Their answer was no.
They're all pursuing other professions and interests in life. We considered a number of different alternatives over the last 5 years of how to hand off the farm.
The Madera County vegetable farmers began working the soil in the 80s. They're local organic pioneers, and letting that legacy of organic farming fade wasn't an option.
A lot of us started 30, 40 years ago, and it's time to hand the baton to someone else. Organic is becoming very, very popular now. It's breaking into big conventional retailers now, like Costco, Walmart, Kroger.
A couple recently announced they're in the process of leasing their farm to Food Commons Fresno. It's the same group that took over the Willie's Food Box program a year and a half ago. Kyle Schmidt is the wholesale and development manager for the group. He says Food Commons Fresno would like to see the region become a farm-to-fork hub like Sacramento is.
Food is a mystery for lots of people, and it just ends up on the grocery store shelf or on your plate, and we want to demystify that as much as possible.
The younger generation taking over this farm is looking forward to building upon what farmers like the Willies have labored over for decades. David Silvera is checking out the soil health on the farm. He'll work the land when it's up and running.
David, how does the soil look?
Looks really rich. Dark soil, very light.
We really improved the tilth of the soil and the workability of the soil over the year, putting all that organic matter that we did in there with compost.
The Willies aren't the only organic farmers looking to young people to take over their farms. Succession efforts are in play across the industry, so much so that groups like the California Certified Organic Farmers and California FarmLink are reaching out to hundreds of farmers to help them with succession plans. The groups are also training young people about organic farming in schools. The reason? Baby boomers are aging out and want to retire. Kathy Calfo is with CCOF.
It's a trend that's in progress. I don't think anyone knows exactly how that's going to play out because the overall economic trends are towards consolidation. But demand for organic has been a big plus for these young farmers.
There are more than 4,000 certified organic businesses in California, and Calfo says there are a surplus of young people that are interested in them. Jane Olvera Quibi is the chair of the Institute for Family Business at Fresno State. She says for many growers, the transition process to a younger generation can be messy, especially if it's staying in the family. That's why she says it's imperative they get outside help when transitioning.
You're going to have a lot of dynamics to navigate that are not just about business, but also about personal. It's trying to find the easiest and smartest path, even when you have generations down the line that are interested in that ownership.
Father and daughter organic stone fruit and raisin growers Moss and Akiko Masumoto are witnessing this firsthand on their farm south of Fresno.
So now you have this millennial generation who, you know, have a different need for compliments and this whole life-work balance.
So what's he getting at, Akiko?
I think the subtext is kind of clear there.
Nikiko's in her 30s, and she moved home to live and work on the farm a few years after earning a master's degree. She realized she didn't want her family's farming history in the Central Valley to disappear if her father were to pass away.
I think, Dad, you really, really do love just grinding away. And I want to stop every once in a while, and I want to pause. And so there's a huge difference.
But Moss doesn't want to just retire and hand the farm over to Nikiko. The farm's his life, and he says it's important they work the land together so Nikiko can learn his reasoning behind the way he farms. Blossom Bluff Orchards near Parlier is going through a similar transition. 39-year-old Bryce Lowen worked in animation and now is learning to farm under his parents' guidance.
If it wasn't so lush and beautiful here, and it wouldn't be if it wasn't an organic farm, I doubt it would come back.
Lowen says he and his sister will eventually take over the 80-acre farm. But for some farmers, having a family member continue farming their land isn't an option. Richard Peterson farmed organic stone fruit in the Reedley area for 4 decades. This was his last season, and now he's retired. His kids weren't interested in taking over the farm, so he found someone else to lease his land.
We like it because he has a son-in-law who's involved, so that's another young person getting into farming. It's very hard for young people to get into farming these days. The capital investment is so great just to buy land.
For all these growers, it's important that their legacies remain. They chose to farm organically when it wasn't popular and for personal reasons like the health of their families and the environment. And as younger people begin to take the reins of the organic movement, it's an opportunity to build upon what the roots of organic farming have labored so hard to grow. With Valley Public Radio News, I'm Ezra David Romero.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. It's a new year, and that means a new chapter in the ongoing saga that is California's high-speed rail project. While construction in the Fresno area is becoming more and more visible with every month, efforts to stop the project are also picking up steam in the courtroom. The center of the fight against the rail line is in Kings County, where a number of farmers are launching legal challenges to the rail project. Here to bring us up to date on that and other news from Kings County is Seth Nidever with the Hanford Sentinel. Seth, welcome.
Thank you very much, Joe.
There's a number of lawsuits against high-speed rail, but the one you write about centers on compliance with Prop 1A. Now, I thought we already heard about this last year, last March. What's going on here? It's back in the news.
Yeah, there's a perception that it kind of went away. You know, they had a court ruling that went against them earlier this year, last year in March. And a lot of news stories sort of seem to imply that the fight that was over, but the way Kings County characterized it, they're a plaintiff in the lawsuit along with a couple landowners. The way they characterize it is that it wasn't ripe. The opportunity to sue wasn't ripe because no Prop 1A money had actually been spent. And so now they say since they are now trying to spend $2.6 billion of Prop 1A money, now the lawsuit is ripe, so they're back in court.
So essentially, what is the complaint? What part of Proposition 1A does the county and these landowners, what are they saying that the state is doing wrong here?
Well, they're claiming that it's not in compliance with several parts of Prop 1A, one of which is the financing requirement. That they say that all the financing needs to be identified in advance before they should start construction. Of course, the authority disagrees with that and says, no, we can segment it and do it in smaller sections. But there are other issues in Prop 1A, such as the speed, the time of the train. It has to meet a certain time requirement, the fastest train from the Bay Area to Los Angeles. And they're claiming it can't meet that. And there are a few other things included in that Prop 1A lawsuit. So
this is now moving forward. Is there a court date? Do we know what the status of this is? What should we expect here with this current lawsuit?
Well, the attorney for Kings County, who represented Kings County, is Stuart Flashman. He's claiming that this will go faster than previous litigation. He says that it's a very simple constitutional question. Does it or does it not comply with Prop 1A? So he thinks it can be adjudicated in the next 3 months. But you know how court proceedings go, I wouldn't bet on that, you know, could go longer.
There's also an irony here in that you have the county suing the High Speed Rail Authority, but the High Speed Rail Authority is also considering this station in Kings County.
That is, it's always been an oddity.
How does that work, and where would that station be, and what's the status of that from what you know?
It's always been a strange oddity about this whole station situation. So Tulare County has been pushing for a station. Of course, the route didn't go through Tulare County. So recently, there was a planning grant that was obtained by the Tulare County Association of Governments for a cross-valley rail that would intersect with the station in Hanford. It would connect Porterville with Huron. Kings County had nothing to do with it. They didn't apply for the grant. They had no part in it at all. They were just passive observers. So Tulare County is planning for a rail route through Kings County that will intersect with the station. It's very, very, very odd, very unusual situation.
Are people in Hanford, certainly there is a great deal of opposition to high-speed rail. Are there some people who are looking forward to it as a potential opportunity for development and those things? You also write about this new Costco that's relatively near that site.
Right. Well, the developers of the Costco marketplace, the Costco shopping center there, they would love to see the station come because one thing they're depending on is they say they need more rooftops visible from the Costco project. Right now, the Costco project is out in the middle of sort of vacant land. I mean, you look around, there's not much there. So they would like to see it. There are also a number of companies in Kings County that are quietly working with High Speed Rail because of the financial opportunity, but they keep it. They tend to keep it on the down low because of the politics against high-speed rail in Kings County.
And I want to go back to the Costco thing in a bit, but what else are we seeing on the ground with high-speed rail right now? They're already buying houses and clearing land, I take it?
They are. I mean, the most visible sign of high-speed rail in Kings County is not the pylons that you see in Fresno, right? It's simply a row of houses that has been demolished on one street east of Hanford in a little subdivision. And high-speed rail may also take the east side of this street, so there are still some residents living there. That's probably the biggest single impact. I mean, the other impacts are so low-key and low visibility that you would almost not even know high-speed rail was operating in Kings County.
Seth Neidiver with the Hanford Sentinel with us today on Valley Edition, talking about the high-speed rail project and the latest legal challenge launched in Kings County against the rail authority and its compliance with Proposition 1A. Other things are going on in Kings County and Hanford as well. You write about the new Costco shopping center. This was a big story, one of the biggest stories really of 2016, the opening of the new Costco. How is it performing? And then we'll get to this other question of what else people want. How is that turning out?
Well, obviously, Costco is a huge hit from the get-go in Kings County. But, I mean, it's pulling from, you know, Tulare County, also Fresno County, as far north as Fowler, Selma, Kingsburg, Corcoran. So it's pulling from this enormous geographical area. So Costco knew that they didn't need any rooftops around the intersection of Highway 43 and Highway 198. They knew people would come because Costco is a destination in and of itself. So Costco obviously is doing great. The parking lot seems to be always full. But then the next steps, that's where it gets tricky. Now, obviously, the smaller places like Starbucks or Subway, they can go anywhere and succeed. They don't really need a huge market area. So they're the first to come. And it's interesting to hear the complaints that people are voicing on our Facebook page and website over these familiar names like Subway and Taco Bell and Verizon coming in. They're the first to come in around Costco.
So what are they saying? What are people asking for? What are they posting on your website?
It's amazing, Joe. It's amazing to read the comments. They're always the same. When we do a story about what's coming around Costco, all the comments are always negative. I can't believe we're getting another Panda Express. We don't need it. We don't need another Taco Bell. We already have two.
What do they want?
You know, they want Dave and Buster's. They want, like, Chuck E. Cheese. They want, like, entertainment options, like John's Incredible Pizza down in Bakersfield. They want family-oriented venues where you can eat and be entertained. And some people, they don't seem to understand why they can't get these places to come, you know. So that's been an interesting subject to explore with some real estate marketers and some other people who have some knowledge of, you know, why they can't bring these places.
There was some concern in Kings County and in Hanford in general, folks in downtown and also in already established retail areas around the Hanford Mall, et cetera, that the Costco Center would cause an exodus of retailers from that part of town. Have we seen that yet, or is it just too early to say?
No, I think the 12th Avenue corridor, the commercial corridor, which is on the west side of Hanford, is super well established and was not going anywhere. I mean, you have a number of anchors there. You have Target, you have Walmart, you have the mall. So that's not going anywhere. The only question is what will happen to downtown Hanford as you create a commercial hub on the east side, and now you have an existing commercial hub on the west side. What happens to the center? And that's the pervasive question.
And that remains to be seen. Speaking of downtown Hanford, another big story last year was both the reopening of the Hanford Fox
right.
Theater after being closed for a long time due to repairs to the ceiling inside the building. And then you had this concert a few weeks ago where, well, tell us what happened.
Yeah, that was a great little example of some impromptu planning on the part of the band. So a piece of plaster fell from the ceiling like just before this group was, and I forget the name of the group.
It's the Brothers Osborne.
There you go, yeah. And just before they were going to go on stage, a piece of plaster fell from, you know, onto the stage. As a precaution, of course, the owner, Dan Humison, said, you know, no, you're not going to perform on stage. But they just went outside, got on top of their tour bus, and the crowd who bought tickets just moved out into the park, and it was this awesome impromptu concert. It made Rolling Stone magazine. It's a big deal.
So the theater has, though, been closed
correct.
Since that bit of plaster fell. And this is a different part of the ceiling than what was replaced over the auditorium,
right.
I guess, in that $3 million restoration. Do you know what's the status there? Are they reopening anytime soon?
Yeah, they're going to reopen, I think, January 27th. It's somewhere later this month. I think what the owner, what Dan Humison told me, was that a lot of they were checking the plaster over the stage just to make sure that it was structurally sound. They didn't have any reason to believe that there was a real major problem. But they think the vibration from the reconstruction of the ceiling over the auditorium, which took so long, is why the theater was closed for so long. They think those vibrations affected the plaster over the stage. So it sounded like a fairly minor issue.
Is there any update on the Bastille finding a new tenant for that?
Oh, right. The famous Bastille, former jail. No, there is not, actually. And the plan is, a couple people have proposed a microbrewery, but they need the city to step up and pay for a bunch of internal improvements to the building. The city hasn't done that yet, and there's still a lot of debate over whether it would be a good investment.
We'll have to see how that will play
exactly.
out, as well as the fate of other things in Kings County. Seth Nidever, staff reporter with the Hanford Sentinel. You can read his reports online at hanfordsentinel.com. It joins us today talking high-speed rail and more. Seth, thanks so much.
Thank you very much, Joe. Appreciate it.
And stay with us on Valley Edition. We'll be back in just a moment and learn how Fresno gave birth to a dance craze that has swept the nation in the hip-hop world. That and local authors getting their books in print from Fresno State. That's all coming up straight ahead on Valley Edition. This is Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. There's a new project at Fresno State that's trying to record people's stories and preserve them. These are stories from a place that's contributed to the world of hip-hop, not San Francisco or Los Angeles, but Fresno. A new oral history project there is documenting the roots of a dance craze. Let's first start by going back a few decades with reporter Alice Daniel. First stop,
Soul Train, the hippest trip in America. 60 nonstop minutes across the tracks of your mind.
Flashback to 1979. Host Don Cornelius has just announced the next act, the Electric Boogaloos.
How about it for him, gang?
Five dancers, all dressed in black, with silver stripes, silver bow ties, silver shoes. Cornelius gets their names. The stars are from Fresno.
Okay.
Sammy Solomon, alias Boogaloo Sam, specializing in Boogaloo.
Timothy Solomon, alias Poppin' Pete Poppin'.
Poppin' Pete demonstrates his moves. He makes his body jerk robotically.
These very creative young men have invented a dancing style that's becoming very popular, and it's described as popping or boogaloo. Or
the crew performs to the funk band, the Barquets.
Here we go.
The Electric Boogaloo's appearance fueled a poppin' dance craze. Poppin' Pete even worked with Michael Jackson on his Thriller video. Deborah McCoy was also dancing in West Fresno in the 70s. She grew up around Poppin' Pete and Boogaloo Sam, and she and her brother Ken were a dancing team. They traveled the state pop-locking and roboting.
I remember we danced at an Armenian church. They called us at a church.
Wow.
We were like, okay, back in the day, dance and church did not mix.
Right.
I don't care who you were. Did not mix. You going straight to hell.
McCoy's talking to historian Sean Slusser, whose new oral history project will be archived at Fresno State. Slusser and his colleagues are collecting photos, video, flyers. They're hoping to build Fresno's hip-hop narrative by interviewing anyone who identifies with the culture. Graffiti artists, MCs, DJs, hip-hop dancers, including b-boys, lockers, and of course, poppers.
That they're using hip-hop the same way, right? It's a way, it's a vehicle of expression. It's a way to kind of, you know, get through economic depression and get through all the kind of problems that we associate with cities.
Deborah McCoy is one of the first participants to be interviewed. She says her family didn't have money, but they still managed to wear fabulous costumes. Her stepmom was a seamstress.
We would go to the thrift stores and buy material. She would sew all of our clothes.
Slusser asks her where she learned her dance styles.
From the street. Yeah. Hey, what do you mean? What do you mean where were we learning? On the street. There was no going... Are you kidding me? I have to say it like this.
Yeah.
You're black and you're going to go take dance lessons? Come on, dude. It's on the street. It's right there. That's how that they were called battles. There was no fighting and,
right.
and all that. You want to fight? Okay, we're dancing.
Like McCoy, the Solomon brothers practice popping at a city-run community center. The historian, Slusser, takes me to the building. It's now a Head Start school.
Yeah, this was a space that they would come to and practice. So they would develop routines that they would then do in kind of local talent shows.
The Electric Boogaloos were pioneers, he says, but popping's exact origins are still up for debate.
One story that's kind of emerged around Boogaloo Sam was that he was in church, in a Baptist church here in Fresno, and that kind of scene, like the sanctified women who, you know, caught the Holy Spirit and would move and dance and kind of spasms and whatnot, that like that was kind of in the back of his mind looking to develop a new dance.
And there's a competing origin story. It revolves around a kid named Ticken Will, who danced with the Solomon brothers early on. He lived in Fresno's Tulare Housing Project and created moves like the old man, imitating a man walking down the street with a cane.
Watch me now.
Over the years, hip-hop in Fresno evolved. In the 90s, dance battles involved kids whose parents were refugees from Laos after the Vietnam War.
Everybody always talks about Fresno when it comes to b-boy in the Hmong community.
That's James Fang. He grew up in a rough area in the 90s and stayed away from gangs by breaking. He says Hmong b-boys made a name for themselves in Fresno and then spread out to other states.
So they brought that b-boy history with them over there to start dancing. And now you have b-boys in Minnesota, North Carolina, Wisconsin.
That history and how it influenced future generations is just one of the chapters Fresno State hopes to document next for its oral history archive. For the California Report, I'm Alice Daniel in Fresno.
Peace will come, this world will rest, once we have...
And you're listening to Valley Edition. It's not just pop culture that is being celebrated at Fresno State these days, though. It's also poets and novelists. Fresno State has a rich tradition in creative writing, from novelists to poets and beyond. The creative writing program this year, though, set a record, or I should say last year set a record, with 8 alumni authors publishing their first books, 4 more coming this year. Joining us now with us on our program, we have 2014 MFA alum Steven Sanchez, who is publishing his new book, To My Body, a poetry book published by Glass Poetry Press. Steven, welcome.
Oh, thank you.
So this is pretty interesting. 8 alumni authors in 1 year, all publishing their first books. That has to be a mammoth task to get to that first milestone. Tell us, in your case, what that was like. What kind of hurdles do you have to face to publish your first collection of poems?
I think the first step that's really important, at least for me, was to, I guess, pretend that nobody was ever going to read what I was writing. Because I think knowing that someone's going to read what you're writing kind of could cripple you with like a lot of self-doubt and fear. So I just kind of went into it thinking, no one's ever going to read this. I can write whatever I need to, what's important to me. And then if it gets published, it gets published. And then luckily it ended up getting published. It's like, okay, cool. Like, now I'm terrified because people are texting me pictures like, oh, your book came in the mail. Like, here's a cover of it. I'm reading it right now. It's like, oh my gosh, like, what are you going to think? Are you going to like judge me for what I wrote about? And but it's a nice feeling to have too, to know that people are actually connecting on that level too.
What's it like working with an editor versus working with your professor, advisor at the university?
There's a lot of similarities, I think, because the editor does a lot of what like my mentors would do in the program at Fresno State, where it's like, I don't know if this line works quite right here. What about trying this out, or raising any questions that they have about the poem? I think what's different, though, is that my mentors, like, I view them as like huge giants to me. Like, I look up to them so much, and I look up to my editors too in the same way. But I feel like the relationship started off more on like a balanced level instead of like having a different power dynamic. So that was kind of an interesting experience to have too, because it's sort of like working on it with a friend as opposed to someone like that I've always held as to like way higher than me, like, sort of.
So tell us a little more about yourself. I sort of jumped right into the book publishing world, but tell us about your background, because I want to hear about that and then hear about some of the other authors that have books coming out.
Okay, I was born and raised in Hanford, California. It's a town about 40 minutes south of Fresno. And I got my bachelor's in philosophy at Fresno State. I was supposed to go to law school. I applied to law schools, got in, but then I took a poetry course and I was like, I actually like poetry a lot more than anything I'm doing.
That's a big change.
Yeah. My parents weren't too thrilled about it at first. I told them, hey, by the way, I'm not going to law school anymore. I'm going to go get a master's in poetry instead. They're like, what? And I was like, yeah, it's like, I really want to pursue it. And if I want to go to law school afterwards, I always can. But then I didn't, because I just ended up becoming so in love with like creative writing and writing poetry.
That could be a new subgenre of lawyer poets, I suppose.
Possibly. It reminds me of this one quote from another poet named, their last name is Shelley. Poets are the unacknowledged legislators of the world, which is kind of a fun overlap.
Yeah, definitely. So tell us about some of your peers who also have books coming out this year, or in the last 12 months, I should say.
So there's 8 of us. Off the top of my head, I can remember Stacey Balkin, who's... book Jackalope Girl Learns to Speak. I actually read a few months ago when it came out, and it's this really cool blending of like retelling of fairy tales in like a context of somebody who's trying to find their own parents or trying to understand what it's like to be adopted or not quite biologically belong, maybe, but also carry these different identities with them. Also, I went to school with like a lot of these people on this list, like Michelle Britton Rosato, Carol Furstman. I think actually we overlapped a little bit. Yinka Rose Reed Nolan. We actually went to school for 2 years together and we became really good friends. JJ and Salmi too. We took a couple of classes together. So it's just really cool seeing these 8 alumni having all their books published. It's like, wow, like I went to school with you. Like I'm reading like your published book, like in my hand right now. And it's really awesome.
So tell me about that. What it's like to read the book of a peer that you went to school with. Do you all sort of exchange notes? Hey, I got your book and you got mine. Critique each other's work, perhaps?
Sometimes, yeah. So Facebook's filled with a lot of like, hey, I got a picture of your, or I got a book and here's a selfie with it. And so it's a lot of sharing like that. And a lot of these, my peers, actually, we do swap work. Like me and Stacey, for instance, have swapped work on several occasions. And Michelle Britton Rosato, we critique each other's work, and seeing it like, with the spine, like in a book format, it's just so cool. Cause it's like, oh, I remember we were sitting at the coffee shop and you spilled your coffee on this copy of the poem when I was giving you that comment on it. And just seeing like having all those memories come to the page along with all the revisions and things that they've done since that conversation is really cool to see how it grows and changes.
From your experience, how hard is it to put the pen down, to not just stop writing, but stop editing, stop massaging something and say, this is the final, the galleys are going to the publisher, there's no more changes, this is it. Is that a little bit terrifying in a way?
Honestly, like even now that I'm looking through like my book that I got, I'm like, I want to change this. I don't quite like this. And like, there's actually edit marks in my book. I think the point for me when I reach, when I stop editing, is when my publisher's like, hey, this is like good as is. We're going to send it off. Like, oh, okay. I'll trust you on this one then.
How do you get connected with the publisher? Because all of these books are, almost every single one is published by a different publisher. Do they seek you out? Do they seek out young talent? Or do you submit work to them? Are there agents involved? How does that process work? Because from the reader's standpoint, I don't think anyone has any idea of what goes on behind the scenes.
Right. So right now it seems like there's three really big genres in writing. There's poetry, nonfiction, or creative nonfiction, and fiction. And it seems, from my understanding, because I'm a poet, so I don't really know the fiction side of things or the nonfiction side of things, but from my friends who've talked about it, they said a lot of times agents are involved for like nonfiction and fiction books. Poetry, on the other hand, it's not as widely read, I feel like, because if you look like at New York Times bestsellers, normally it's not a collection of poetry that's on there. So we don't actually get agents. It's more like submitting to contests, or the way that my book got published was I had submitted my poems to the Indianola Review, which is an independent literary journal, and the editor really liked one of my poems, and he emailed me saying, hey, like, I want to publish like a chapbook of yours if you'd let me. I was like, okay, cool, like, let's work on it together.
Let me stop you there. What's a chapbook?
So the way I look at it is like the difference between a CD and an EP. Like, a CD is like a full-length album, like an hour of music or something, and an EP is sort of like 15, 20 minutes of music, like a sampling of what's going to come in the future. And so the chapbook is like an EP. It's sort of a smaller collection of poems that are kind of like a preview of what your full-length work is going to look like in the future. And then the actual full-length book is more like a full-length CD album.
So you, I take it, then have a larger work coming in the near future?
I do, actually. My first full-length book is coming out in 2018 from Sundress Publications.
Tell me a little more about the book that you have out now.
To My Body, a lot of the poems deal with issues of like race and sexuality, and my experiences with like rejecting and accepting those parts of my own identity, and how I kind of relate to those now. A lot of it came from actually the community at Fresno State, especially my peers that I made in the writing program, because they're all very encouraging, very supportive. I was kind of self-conscious writing about these things. I'm like, no, go for it. Like, you need to. And I think that was the best part about Fresno State's writing program, is that everyone there was so supportive and nurturing, the faculty too, which I really appreciated.
We have a few minutes left. If you have a short poem maybe that we could hear that you could read for us today.
This one's called What I Didn't Tell You, and I wrote it for my brother. You can ask me anything. Even about my first kiss, which was at your age, and it tasted like stale beer. I used to feel guilty swallowing the pulse of another man, but now I know there are several ways to pray. There's a name for the most intimate prayer, La Petite Mort, the little death. If, when your lover rakes your back, you recall the flock of worshippers surrounding you like carrion when they learned you're gay, their hands clawing into your shoulders, their voices squawking for your salvation, remind yourself you must die to resurrect. Never forget what the Bible says. When two people worship, you create a church, no matter where you are, the back seat of your lover's car or the darkest corner of Woodward Park. These are some of the things I wanted to tell you that night in April you called me for help with your history report about the gay rights movement. Neither of us admitted what we knew about each other, those white lies we tell ourselves sometimes, surrounding us like flies that know something's dying. I started with the ancient Greeks, told you it was normal for them, that for one brief moment they were allowed to write their own histories and religion, organizing the stars, forming celestial bodies like Orion flexing in the sky, his arms open in victory, his belt hanging below his waist. But Orion was punished for his confidence. A scorpion's hooked tail pierced his body like a poisonous moon. When I see Orion, I think of you and remember what it felt like for my knuckles to sink into your stomach, for my fist to collide with your face. Your voice, your walk, your gestures reminded me of myself, your body confident and fluid, creating a reflection I wanted to break. And now I see your body spilling open, the Big Dipper hooked to your ribs, the North Star nestled in the middle of it. I reach for this ladle and drink.
That's poet Stephen Sanchez joining us today on A Valley Edition, reading from his collection of poems, To My Body, talking about the new books that are published by Fresno State Creative Writing Alumni. You're vice president of the alumni chapter, of the Creative Writing Alumni chapter.
Right.
You have people in all sorts of different stages of their career, people who are very well-known authors, to grads who are fresh out of the program right now. Tell me a little more about what that community is like, being a part of this group, this cohort, so to speak.
It's amazing because, like, I still feel like I'm just barely starting out, which, I mean, I am just starting out. And it's nice having all these alumni who've kind of been around, know, like, the ropes of the game and have, like, books published. And it's nice to go to them as, like, sort of mentors. And it's also nice to see, like, the new up-and-coming students in the program, too, and, like, all their new insights and ideas. And whenever there's, like, readings, like, there's always, like, this overlap. It's, like, multiple generations in a family sort of thing. Like, everyone has their own stories that they all know about. And, like, when you share, it's like, oh, I didn't know that. And it feels like a family to me, honestly, when I go to, like, these Fresno readings and there's alumni and friends of the Creative Writing Program all reading together. It's really nice.
So now, is there one place that people can go to get these books if they're looking for them? Or what would you suggest? People are looking for your book or somebody else's?
Actually, if you go to the Fresno State, I think actually the Fresno State Creative Writing blog has a link to all the books that alumni have published. So you can look, and it shows their names, a brief bio, and a link to where you can actually purchase their books.
All right, we'll do that and look for those and the works of other local authors as well, as we regularly feature local authors on Valley Edition. Again, Stephen Sanchez, vice president of the Fresno State Creative Writing Alumni Chapter. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
And that's all for today's Valley Edition. As always, we'd like to know what you think. You can email us, talk@kvpr.org, or send us a tweet. We are at KVPR and at Valley Edition. You can also find audio archives and podcasts on our website as well at kvpr.org. For Valley Edition producer and reporter Ezra David Romero, reporters Jeffrey Hess and Carrie Klein, audio engineer Marv Allen, and production and operations manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, dedicated to a healthcare system that works for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.